Hi, I'm Nicky from Armstrong Customs, and you're listening to the Functional Tennis Podcast.
Welcome to episode 14 of the Functional Tennis Podcast. This week, we speak to Nicky from Armstrong Customs. Nicky talks about all things strings, racket customization, and even playing with Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray's rackets. We answer questions from our followers on Instagram, and we break it up into sections on strings, stringing, racket customization, and painting rackets. There's a lot of great questions in there, a lot of great answers, and stuff for me being 20 years in tennis, did not know about a lot of these things. So very insightful there. It's our longest episode by a mile. And if you're into stringing and want to know a little bit about Nicky from Armstrong, make sure you listen to this. Hi, Nicky. Welcome to the Functional Tennis Podcast.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you on the podcast. I've been looking forward to this one for a while. I've known about Armstrong Customs now for a long time. You've done some rackets for some friends of mine, Dave O'Hare, Sam. You did rackets for Sam, did you?
Yes, yeah, we did Sam, we did Dave, and a couple of others.
Great. And obviously I know your work with Andy Murray and Novak Djokovic. So yeah, and we've loads of questions to ask you. Our followers had asked loads of questions, so can't wait to ask you them. Before we get into the stringing and the customization, where did tennis start for you, Nicky?
Well, I started obviously playing tennis at a young age, I think, as a lot of us do. And then I was competing, I was traveling on the Futures Tour, and I'm trying to play professionally. And and that was obviously when we met back in, do you remember what year it was?
I was trying to figure that out. I didn't go onto Google to search for results because I probably would have cried. But I think it was about October. It was either October 2010 or 2011 in Greece. It was the Greece Future Circuit.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember it was in Greece. So it was in one of the islands in Heraklion.
Yeah, there was a few tournaments in the islands there. And I decided to travel with the Irish lads. It was a good team of six or seven Irish lads. That was an amazing crew. And I said I'd give it a go for a month and see what would happen. But it wasn't, let's say, my late stab at tennis started there and ended there. It was a great experience for me, and to see how hard it is on the Futures Tour, it was extremely difficult. I know you were there with a good entourage. You were hanging out with Novak's brother Marco, was that it?
Yeah, that was actually the first time we met there. Yeah, there was a few of us that come from the group that I trained with here in Spain, and that was the first time that Mark and I met. And then obviously later he came to train with us, and he's one of my best friends now, so he lives here as well with in the same area as me. We used to train together, travel together.
Great. So it wasn't you. So I remember there was Marco used to just dress in Novak's clothes and use his rackets, and there was the other guy Stilitano. I thought they used to just they used to just raid Novak's wardrobe and wear all his clothes.
Yeah, I mean, the top guys get so much stuff, so it's a shame that it goes to waste anyway. So
at least those guys were wearing it. So yeah, so that's where I first met you, and then did you play the Dublin Futures?
I played once, yeah, but I don't remember. Again, it was a long time ago, so I don't know. But yeah, so I don't remember when that was. But yes, yeah, so I've played, and then I stopped playing relatively early when I was 24, more or less. I started to, I eased off. Yeah, and I moved on to other things.
When did stringing start for you? Did you string were you stringing your own rackets while you're traveling?
Yeah, I've always been interested in stringing and customizing and stuff. I actually started learning when I was 14, 15, when I was out in Spain. So the small club that I was training at the time, the head coach there was also a good stringer, and he sort of first taught me to string, and that was kind of where it all started. And I started learning quite early on, and then growing up, I was always there was a pro shop near where I lived in London, and that was where I was kind of able to practice more and string more. And then obviously I was working there part time, and yeah, so stringing has always been like a passion, let's say, of mine. And as I was traveling, I was always trying to find ways to sort of find a machine to travel with, or string as I was traveling, or string for other players. Yeah, that was always kind of my thing.
I know now there's the pro stringer by Nathan Rubin, who developed a small little stringer machine. What did you travel with back then?
Yeah, I was actually one of the first guys to use the pro stringer back then. I kind of discovered it quite early on, and I got in touch with Rubin, and he sent me a machine to try and use, and I kind of try to help promote them and stuff like that. It was, I really like the machine. I mean, obviously it has its limitations, but as a machine to travel with, it's, in my opinion, it's the best one. So yeah, so I strung, I don't know how many hundreds, maybe thousands of rackets on that little machine. You know, I was able to string on a table, on chair, I've strung on the edge of a minibar, literally on any flat surface I've been able to string a racket.
Do you ever string in an airport?
No. I'm not strung in an airport, but literally on any flat surface I could find, I've been able to string a racket.
I must reach out to Ruben at some stage and we get his story on the invention of the machine on here, because it's such a genius idea.
Yeah, it's really great. The whole concept of it, and obviously he's developed it further. So like when it started off, it was the same size, but it was like it had a dial, so you had to turn to change the tension, which just means that, you know, the reading that you were getting maybe was slightly off. But then once you found, you know, once you get used to it and you found your range, then it was great. And one of the things that's actually great about the machine is that it has constant pull, which I'll speak of a little bit about later on. But it's, yeah, in such a small size and in such a handy machine, it's great.
Great. Well, yeah, we'll try to get him on. It's great that you like it. So you were stringing from a young age. You got some work in the pro shop. When did your company, Unstrung Customs, come about?
It came about in 2014. I think we officially started. I've got two colleagues that I knew separately, and I kind of been speaking to both of them about the possibility of setting something up a little bit more serious. At the time, we were just thinking of being, you know, like a stringing customizing company, like you have the other big brands like P1, like Ringroll. And so I had the idea to put the three of us together, and so I headed up the business, and we started in 2014, and then it's just kind of been growing bit by bit. In the beginning it grew quite slowly because obviously it wasn't our number one main focus for any of us. We understood that it would take perhaps a little bit longer than obviously if we were to go all in, which we were fine with, but then through our connections and our and also the quality of our work as well, that it started to grow and grow, and then obviously more in the last year, 2 years, it's been doing nicely.
Great, because I know you string rackets for Andy Murray, obviously for Djokovic, and you've good access to some good players, which does help business.
Yeah, of course it does help. It does help. Yeah, my colleague Darren, who's in the pro shop, the one that I started honed my stringing at in London, which is it's called Wimbledon Park Sports, just next to the All England Club. He strings for Andy whenever Andy's in London practicing, training. He's stringing his rackets. Then I take care of Novak's rackets when he's here in Spain doing his pre-season, preparing the fourth tournament.
Is that shop the one beside Wimbledon in the little village?
It's on the road actually between the tube station that you need to go to get to Wimbledon, which is called Southfields.
Okay.
And then walk up towards the, it's like a 5 minute walk up to All England, to the tennis club, to the Wimbledon Championships.
Did I see you? Was I in there once and I saw you in there?
Yes, I think okay. So. Exactly. Well, we met exactly that. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure if that was PWP or it was this other store.
Yeah, no, it's that one. It's just, it's changed names a few times since then.
Okay.
So now it's just.
So at Unstrung, your services involve obviously the basic stringing. You do racket customizations. Mm-hmm. You paint rackets, which is amazing, which we'll talk about. You've done some amazing rackets. You do a bit of consulting. And you also now have a new fancy 3D technology where you do custom palettes. Tell us about the custom palettes. I don't know too much about them.
Yeah, so basically it was a couple of years ago. We were at a symposium, like a racket stringer symposium. And for example, for a lot of pro players, they have their own, they like a certain grip size, a certain shape, and therefore they have their grips molded to the shape and size that they like. And anyway, we were at the symposium and there was a presentation on the molding. And it's the way that it's always been done, but it was just quite time consuming. It's quite expensive, very expensive. And it was just, one of those moments where you think, there's got to be an easier way, yeah, or a better way. And it just came to me. I was like, maybe we can just 3D print these. And at the time, I didn't realize how much work it would be. Because, when you start, like with most things, when you think of 3D printing, you're like, you just put it into a machine and it comes out and it'll be great. Obviously, with tennis rackets, the whole, anyone that plays at like a good level, top level, want their racket to be the same at a certain weight. So obviously, any extra gram here or there, it makes a difference. So there's no, you can't cut corners with regards to weight. So it was like over a year and a half, nearly 2 years in testing to get to the finished product that we're at now. So it basically means that, for example, say you've played with head rackets your whole life,
yeah,
and you really like the head the head shape, and then but suddenly you played with a bad luck racket and it's the best racket you've ever played with, but you don't like the shape of the grip. At the moment, there aren't really any, I mean, except for the molding option, there aren't any ways for you to be able to play with that shape grip on that racket. Yeah, until we came up with this idea to 3D print these palettes, which basically means that sort of any competent stringer customizer is able to change your palette. So they'd remove the foam that's there and then replace them with like a head shape grip on your Babolat racket.
Well, did I read somewhere that the cost of molding the grip is about £2,000?
So, for example, if you want your own custom mold, say you have your favourite racket with your favourite grip and it has to be that one, then if you're on your own custom mold, it's £2,000 for a molding. Yeah. And as a business as well, each mold is £2,000. And you have to remember, you need a mold for each grip size, each grip shape. You know, you'll end up with an inventory of maybe a 30 mold, £2,000 each or €2,000 each is an expensive cost. And for example, say the company does molding and you just want a standard size, a standard shape, it'll probably cost you around £80 to £90, well, euros, €90 per racket. But not only that, you also have to send your rackets off. They need the rackets for a couple of, or probably a week, because obviously the molding has to dry. And then with molding, for example, if you imagine when you take the foam off a racket, it's just the thin metal beam. I don't know if you've seen a hairpin of a racket yet. And then you set that in a mold. But obviously if that racket is just 1% off being completely level or completely centered, the effect that that has on the molding, on the grip molding has quite a large impact. So the margin for error on that is quite large, and it's quite obviously it's dependent on the person doing it knowing what they're doing very, very well. Because obviously if you just offset the racket, or you don't, I mean, either you just happen to knock it ever so slightly or whatever, then you mold it and your molding's going to be off. The main aspect, the great thing with the 3D palette, with the printing system, is that they're printed to 0.1 millimeter of accuracy, which means that, for example, if I print you a palette today, you can put it on your racket and it'll be perfect. And obviously they come in two halves, so they're obviously, the racket's always going to be centered. If I print the same palette in a year's time, it's going to be exactly the same. You know, and you'll put it on and it'll be exactly the same. It won't be dependent on the foam density. It won't be dependent on, you know, on the racket being centered. It won't be dependent on it, on pretty much anything. You know, it's foolproof, which is, you know, one of the large advantages of it.
So basically, if I've been playing with head all my life, changing to Wilson, and I prefer the squarer head grip, I basically send you a message and say, hey, Nicky, I'd like some head palettes for my Wilson size 3. And you basically, in a week or two or three, however long it takes to 3D print them, send them to me and I give them to my stringer and they can look after it.
Exactly. I mean, we're building a stock now at the moment, which means, so I think actually by the end of the month, we'll have full range of stock so people can order them directly from us. You know, we ship them out, depending obviously where you are, but it shouldn't take, you know, more than a couple of days to arrive. And they'll come with instructions on how to mount them. And it's very simple. Once you know how to do it, it's very simple. I mean, if you can string and customize, then it's not rocket science, so it's quite simple. Yeah, and then, you know, you just order them from us and then you put the palettes on and that's it. And you're good to go.
Sounds good. And tell me, do Andy and Novak, what palette do they use?
So Andy has his grips molded, if I remember rightly, they're grip size 2. Grip size, are they 2? See, I think so. I
2?
Think 2. He has his own personal mold, so they're somewhere between a 2 and a 3.
Okay.
So yeah, he has his own personal mold that P1 do for him on all his rackets. And then Novak is just using regular palettes.
Okay.
He's using regular head palettes in a grip size 3.
I did read somewhere that Andy is no longer with P1.
I mean, well, now that he's sort of stopped playing, I'm not sure what, they do a great job, but they obviously, if you're not using their services at all the tournaments, I guess they're probably not cheap. But for example, I'm sure they might still do his rackets, you know, like his grip molding and stuff. There's, you know what, because obviously one, I mean, I'm not sure, obviously I can't speak to them, but I think, you know, they do maybe just the customizing, and then obviously they send you all your rackets, and then obviously as a company, you can be part, like they'll be part of your team, they'll take care of your rackets at all the tournaments and so on. So I guess it's probably two different, you know, aspects. So he might not be with them in the sense of, you know, they're not going to travel to his tournaments or string for him. You know, he can use the on-site stringers or not. I don't know who he's using, but I would assume that they're still going to customize his frames. But I don't know.
I just listened to one of the guys, Ron, on a podcast. I think he was saying he didn't do Andy's rackets anymore. But as you say, maybe that's not touring. Maybe they look after a batch every year.
Yeah, maybe. Or not. I mean, maybe he's using I can't say.
I did hear another thing. Andy does not like to give away his rackets. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. He's he doesn't like to give away his rackets. He keeps them. I know he's got a big room in his house that I've seen photos of. You know, just with hundreds of frames. Yeah, which I mean, I understand to a certain point, because obviously, unfortunately, a lot of people try to get, you know, pro rackets and then sell them and make money off them and stuff like that, which is not ideal. You know, one thing is, I'm sure, for example, you know, he gives them away to charity or to friends, or, you know, there are some serious collectors as well that are in it for the rackets. You know, it's different if you trade rackets that the interest is the rackets and not the money behind the rackets, then it's different, you know. But obviously his, you know, if you have a racket of his that's been, you know, maybe he's played with it at Grand Slam, or even as long as he's used it, you know, it could be worth a couple of thousand.
I have seen, there is a website out there that sells pro player rackets, and they have some, they've Dimitrov's rackets. I think at one stage I did see an Andy Murray racket there. I just don't know how to get their hands on these rackets. It's amazing because they...
No, yeah, I mean, the guy must have some good contacts. Yeah, there are always some good rackets on there. However, the prices are not so cheap. No. So,
even they do the pro stock, the pro stock Wilson, the H22s are some of the head special, the made in Austria rackets, and I just don't know how they can get their hands on 10 or 20 a batch of new rackets at a time.
No, I don't know either. I mean, it's the sort of thing that, I mean, I guess if you create a business on it, then that's great. But it's just, from a person, like, obviously we get a lot of requests. Oh, can you source these rackets? Oh, do you sell these rackets? Yeah. And we have a policy of just saying no, because from a personal point of view, I don't think it's
ethical.
Yeah, exactly. It's not ethical from a brand perspective, from the different brands, you know. One thing is, if a player contacts us, look, do you have a contact to Wilson or to Head to try and get some frames? Then that's one thing, you know, to help them get frames. But, you know, to directly, hey, I'm looking for, I don't know, PT57A in a grip size 3. Oh, I want 4. Can you get me some? You know, we just always flat. Even if we could, we wouldn't do it, because it's it's just not ethical. It's not, you know, it's not right. So yeah, we're trying to avoid all of that.
You've hit with Murray, with Andy's and Novak's racket. What are they like?
Yeah, they are heavy for a start. They're heavy.
What sort of weight are they?
For Novak's frames, I mean, he was using, as you guys might know, he changed that up kind of recently, ever so slightly. So he was using the same frame, so the same racket, which is a square beam. It's an old radical mold, and he was playing 18-20 string pattern. So and it's actually a 95 head, so it's quite a
dense
string pattern. Yeah, and I don't know if you know this, so actually a lot of the old head rackets that are advertised as 98 square inches. So for example, the Prestige and everything say they're 98. They're actually head at the time measured them on the outside of the frame. So the actual inside head size is actually 95.
So which rackets are these now?
So these will be, the current Prestige, which if you look at the specs, it says 98, but it's actually a 95 because it's actually 98 on the outside. But rumor has it that it might be changing for the next.
What they say on the spec or the actual size of it?
Just the head size itself.
That's mad.
It's just measured, because normally you measure, for example, you normally measure a head size on the inside of a racket, the inside surface area of of the string bed. But for whatever reason, ages ago, someone had measured them on the outside. So obviously it makes it larger. So for example, the Novak is playing with a 95-inch square-inch head size.
Well, I never knew that. That's mad. So that explains all my shanks anyway.
Yeah. So exactly. He plays heavy. He was using, I think he was at 368 grams with everything, with grips. He plays with 2 over grips and a vibration dampener. And his swing weight was high. It was in the 340 something area. And then he was obviously, he had a bit of trouble with the elbow and stuff, and he was looking for a bit more power. And so he just modified his setup slightly. So he's using an 18-19 string pattern. And and he's actually got half an inch longer on the frame. So his frame is actually half an inch longer than it was before, which is not much. But yeah, I guess he feels a slight difference. It gives him a little bit more power. Also, the 18-19 string pattern just opens up the string bed ever so slightly. So he gets a little bit more power, a little bit more spin. And then he's reduced the weight a fair bit. He's taken nearly 10 grams off, I think, if I remember right. So he's down around 354 or something like that, I think, all in. So yeah, just, you know, he's able to accelerate a little bit faster. It takes a little bit of pressure off his joints and stuff. So.
And how did you find using the racket?
Great. I personally prefer the 18-20. I've always played very heavy. I mean, I remember when I was 12, I was already using, do you remember the Dunlop 200G?
Yes, the black one.
The black one, yeah. The
black gray, beautiful racket, yeah.
Muscle Weave. And that was, you know, already 315 grams unstrung or 320 grams unstrung. You know, so at 12, I was using like 350 gram racket pretty much. So I've always played very heavy. So I think they're great. I mean, the frame is very nice because it's solid. You get a lot of feedback from the frame, which is also why that, you know, for commercial use, they're perhaps not perfect because they, you know, that unless you're playing with gut, unless you're in, you know, great physical shape, then they can, you know, you could get injured. You know, there's a lot of feedback in the arm, you know, like this, that, which is great. You get a lot of feeling from the ball. You get, you know, a very clean, sweet spot, clean strike. However, it is a lot of pressure on the arm, the wrist, you know, the joints. So, but yeah, I mean, I like it very much. It's a great feeling frame.
And is Andy Murray's racket the same, roughly, not wouldn't be roughly the same weight, is it?
Yeah, he also actually quite a few years ago, I don't know if you remember, he changed weight. He was like, I can't remember exactly, but he was up in the 370 something
wow.
range. Yeah, also 18-20. He was using the PC57A, which is just the old Pro Tour Prestige.
That's the blue one, is it? The blue and black one?
Exactly, the blue and black one. Yeah, exactly that one. Yes, it was just, obviously it was too much. So he reduced the weight. He was, for quite a while, he was chopping and changing, I think, between string patterns. I'm not sure what he's using now, what he was using most recently, but he dropped weight a lot. He went down from 370, 380 down to just under 360, I think. For them, you know, it just means that they can accelerate faster. They can, you know, obviously having to hit, just repeatedly hit, you know, aggressive top spin or angles, or anytime you have to move the racket slightly when you're out of position or you're defending, like those 10-15 grams make a big, big difference.
He's a 95 head also, so.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a 95 head as well. Yeah, the funny thing with that racket is the racket he uses, the PT57A, has a lot of, like, it's like, let's say it's a famous pro stock racket, like a lot of people look for it, you know, it just has a name, but it's actually, you know, if you take the current Prestige, the regular Prestige, it's the same mold, you know, it's the same shape. You could, you know, for example, if I gave you a pro stock, you know, it's like the PT57A and the current model paint with the same paint job, there is no way to tell the difference, like none whatsoever. It's just that the layup can be slightly different. The flex of the PT57A, I think, is a little bit lower. Again, because back then the power levels were lower in the frames. The flexion of the racket was normally around 59 RA, which is just the unit that the rackets are measured in flex. Whereas, like, I think the retail frames are a little bit higher. It just means that the racket's a bit more solid on impact. It gives you a little bit more power. Again, just to, I think, to enlarge the sweet spot slightly, just to, again, make them a little bit more playable. Because, again, for example, you know, there's a reason that the top pros are using a certain racket, but they're also in a certain physical shape and have a certain ability to use those frames, you know. So from, like, it doesn't really make sense that, you know, that you're, the recreational player should be using the same setup or the same frame as, you know, two of the fittest players ever to play the game.
It's a bit like a race car. Like,
exactly.
They're just so highly configured that if a normal driver doesn't know how to use the proper race car, they're not going to get the most out of it. So you need to be trained in the profession. I used to use, James McGee used to give me his racket. So he used to use Prestiges and had loads of them, but I realized they're not for me. And then he made the switch to Radical and it was such a nicer racket for me. Now he had, his setup was a bit, he had a different string bed than the standard racket. It was a bit different, which I got used to and I thought was a great racket. And which I sort of use a Radical now, which is roughly the same setup as it, but definitely the Prestige, you got to be a gifted player to use. But do you, I know that old Prestige, the blue one that a lot of players use, come from a certain generation. What's the popular racket now with players?
I think a lot of the players, let's say like the younger generation, a lot of them are using the Blade and the Radical are the two of the rackets that are kind of getting a lot of attention at the moment.
Is it the current Blade or is it a Is it a H? I know their stock model is a H22, H19.
Wilson, probably the most popular player frame is a frame called the H22, which is what Novak was using when he was at Wilson. And that's very similar to the frame, to the old sort of square beam radical, you know, like the iRadical.
Oh, yes.
Or the, you know, that kind of generation, or the liquid metal radical. That it's kind of like that, looks and feels kind of similar to that, I guess. I mean, the Wilson have their own, you know, have their own materials, but a lot of their players, pro players, use that, but a lot of them are also using the regular blade. Whether, obviously, to say which model they're using is difficult to say. They normally use, like, the pro stock rackets from all the brands are always Goss, well, nearly always Goss. So, for example, you know, Goffan is using a blade just in gloss paint. He doesn't use, you know, that kind of rubbery texture.
Why
paint.
Is that?
I think maybe it's just feeling in the hand, you know, that obviously he's just used to that feeling.
Okay.
Like, you know, I don't know. I don't know a specific reason.
It's not that it looks better in photos or...
Maybe. Yeah. I think at the end of the day, for example, if Goffan wanted to use the frame that you could actually, you know, looks exact or is exactly the same, that, you know, that he would, I think it's more a question of personal preference, you know, or, you know, that obviously the blade did used to be gloss. So he was using the blade back when it was gloss. And then, you know, they changed the paint on it, but he still liked the feeling because that's what he's been used to, you know. And also the big Canadian Raonic, he's also using the blade. Yeah. There are a lot of players using the blade, but, you know, it's a great frame. And then also the radical, you know, you have Taylor Fritz using it, you have Schwartzman, Sloan Stevens. So they're kind of the more popular frames, I guess, at the moment. And I think that generation, kind of prestige generation, is slowly dying
out.
Yeah, I think so, unfortunately. Unless,
yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. Unless kind of tennis starts to shift to being, you know, faster again, I can't see, you know, it's going to be tougher for that kind of style of racket to survive. Doesn't matter how big or strong you are, you need some help from your friend. You know, there's no point using a racket that has, you know, a 2-inch sweet spot, you know, and a power, yes, and a low power level, if, you know, if someone the same size and build is using, you know, something a lot more powerful and a lot more forgiving.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Those days are over. But yeah, thanks for telling us some secrets of those rackets. We're going to break into the Q&A now that our followers, the questions they've left us now. I'm going to split it into 5 sections. It's going to be a section on stringing, a section on strings, a section on rackets, which we've talked about some of the questions already, a section on racket customization, and then we have a couple of questions on your painting of rackets.
Perfect.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to kick into it. I know I've sent you the questions there. We start with stringing. Now, I have some of the names of the people who left questions.
Okay.
Some others I don't, because their Instagram handles don't say their name. They say other things.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm going to quickly jump into stringing here. It's a question from William. Why do people have higher tension on mains than on the crosses?
So basically, I mean, from kind of like a physics point of view, obviously, if you look at the length of the mains compared to the length of the crosses, there's obviously quite a significant difference in length. So just obviously, if you have a longer piece of string at the same tension as a shorter piece of string, the tension on that shorter piece of string will be higher. So it basically means that, for example, if you have the string racket all the same tension, which is totally fine, and a lot of players do, it just means that the crosses are going to be relatively tighter than the mains, which in some frames can actually, at very high tensions, can actually kind of change the shape of the racket ever so slightly. You will also get a little bit better kind of trampoline effect if you lower the tension in the crosses. It will just allow the mains to move slightly more, just a little bit more. And so I personally, I'd always recommend going a kilo or 2 pounds less in the crosses. So for example, say you string at 25 kilos, which is 55 pounds, I recommend stringing, you know, 25 in the main, 24 in the crosses, or 55 pounds and 53 pounds. You're just going to feel, you should feel anyway, that the ball's going to just pop a little bit more. But like I said, there are players that, you know, there are many top players that do use the same tension all around. So there's no, it's not necessarily wrong. The only thing I wouldn't do is ever have the mains tighter than the crosses. Then you end up with like a round head, and that's not good for the racket.
Great. So, okay, that's good. I know Fran, your partner, has told me to string racket and make sure you go. I'd probably string a 54. He goes, do 54, 52. But I actually never knew the reason for it. So
it's
great to know that. Next question is, what is a pre-stretch? Now, I'm just going to quickly jump in here. Whatever, 20 years getting racket strung, nobody's ever mentioned pre-stretch to me. And I did see even Serena Wilson put up a picture of Serena's racket getting her label on her racket for the US Open. It had like 10% pre-stretch. What does that mean?
So pre-stretch is, something that you generally only do with natural gut. There are, strangely, some players that do it with polyester string, but I definitely wouldn't recommend it. So basically, it means you can only do this on, you can only really do this on the electric machine. So basically, what it means is, say you string a racket, you're stringing gut mains, for example, and you want to string at 24 kilos. And what pre-stretch does, pulls the string, whatever percentage you set it at. So say you set it at 10% pre-stretch, which is kind of the norm. It means it'll pull it at 10% more of your tension and then go back to 20. So say, for example, you're pulling at 24 kilos. You want your racket at 24 kilos. You put the string in the machine. It pulls it back at 24. Then it adds 10% more. So it'll pull it to 26.4. And then it'll go back to 24. And then it'll beep. And then you can put the clamp. What this does, it just removes a little bit of the elasticity in the string, which especially with natural gut, it's quite a lively, quite a dynamic string. So just by pre-stretching it, it makes it slightly stiffer and just reduces that extra elasticity. Funnily enough, Babolat, who are probably the sort of leaders in natural gut, they actually don't recommend it. However, nearly all the players kind of use it.
Interesting. Yeah, well, I don't think many people use natural gut. So.
No, so it's not, I wouldn't recommend trying to pre-stretch polyester, because again, you just, it's going to end up with a very dead string bed if you pre-stretch polyester.
Great. Yeah, I did read, only recently I heard about Babolat, that what they used to do is offer, if you used a Babolat racket back in the day, they give you free gut, and that's how they grew their brand. Yeah. That's how they grew so quickly, because exactly. They used to offer the free gut. Okay, so this is an interesting one. The next one, it's a simple but interesting, because I find it's a lazy stringer's option.
Okay. But
two knots versus four knots, what's the difference?
So I mean, there's no, again, so this, a lot of the sort of meeting or symposiums that we go to, always is a question that always comes up. There's no right or wrong to two knots or four knots, only obviously, so basically means you can obviously string two knots as if you string the whole racket with one piece of string, so obviously you end up just with two knots, and four knots is if you string the mains, tie off the mains, and then you start with a new piece of string and you string the crosses, then you end up with four knots. Obviously, if you use two different types of string, you have to use four knots. Obviously, a lot of players also use the same string all over. And generally these days, most players actually ask for four knots. If you were to ask them why, they wouldn't really know. There is no right or wrong. It makes stringing easier, because some rackets, depending on their string pattern, you end up, with the main finishing at the bottom, and then you need to know how to get back up to the top. So it just makes stringing slightly easier on string patterns that you aren't familiar with. A colleague of mine did a test last year or the year before, where he strung the same racket with the same tension twice, two of them with two knots and two of them with four knots, same tension, same stringer, same machine. And for some reason, the racket that was strung in one piece and two knots came out at 1 dB higher, which is dynamic tension. Is this, we have a little machine that goes on the string bed, which reads the dynamic tension of the strings, which is kind of what we gauge sort of for accuracy of stringing at tournaments and stuff. And 1 dB point, one dynamic tension point, is roughly half a kilo. So it just comes out ever so slightly tighter. Why? Not really sure. But there's no right or wrong. So you can do either.
And what about, would the four not maintain its tension any better? Any tests done on over the...
As long as the outside mains are... Like if the racket's strung properly or by a good stringer, they both play... they'll both maintain the tension the same. There won't be any extra tension loss because of, having more knots. The only, obviously, two knots looks nicer, I guess. You only have two knots. But sometimes you need... In some cases, you need a more experienced stringer to string two knots on certain rackets.
Okay. I actually thought it was the other way around, that the two knots was a lot easier. But okay, so there's no real difference there. I know pros used to string a lot higher the tension. They seem to have come down. So what's the average tension that the pros are stringing at?
To be honest, there's no... They vary so greatly that there is no average, there's no kind of trend neither. The players that are using gut are generally stringing a lot tighter. So for example, the ones that are using a mixture of gut mains and polyester crosses or the reverse are generally stringing between 25 to 28 kilos roughly. And then the ones that are using all poly are generally a little bit lower, sort of. I mean, there are players stringing at even 14 kilos, so yeah.
What's 14. That in pounds? About 40, is it?
It's 30.8 pounds, so 31 pounds.
Is it a trampoline they're playing with?
Yeah, literally. I mean, I think, I can't remember who it was. I remember my colleague telling me that their lowest tension at Wimbledon this year was who was it? But it was something like 27 and a half pounds. Yeah, it's mad. But so it just really goes on personal preference. You know, I mean, for example, Novak is on the high end. He plays around 28 and a half kilos, but he is using gut. And then, yeah, like I said, there are players all the way down, you know, in the 30 pound mark. So it really depends on personal preference.
Well, okay. So what's a good stringing machine for a junior player or somebody who likes to string, a recreational stringer?
For example, I mean, like we spoke earlier about the pro stringer, which for like a junior, I think is great. You know, they might be traveling to tournaments, they can take it with them. It's an electric machine. It has constant pull. So constant pull basically means that when the tension head pulls the string, it keeps the string at that tension. For example, if you put your finger and push down on the string, the tension head will adjust to constantly keep the string at the right tension. So for example, a crank machine doesn't have constant pull. You pull the string to the tension that you want and that's it. You know, so if you were to push on that string, that there would be no adjustment. Funny enough, actually, drop weight machines are constant pull because they're constantly pulling that tension on the string. So actually, sometimes a good drop weight machine can actually be a little bit better than a crank machine.
A drop weight machine is,
if you remember the old sort of, this slightly smaller machines, they have like a long pole and then with a weight at the top.
Okay.
And then that weight drops. You have to move the weight along the bar to set the right tension. So as that weight drops, it then pulls like a lever, pulls the string to that tension. But then because the weight is obviously constantly on the string, it actually makes it a constant pull. But anyway, in answer to your question, you kind of have two categories of, if we just kind of stick to electric machines, you can pick up a nice electric machine, you know, a good secondhand electric machine, around 500 euros, 500 pounds.
What brand would that be?
You have a couple from Gamma do nice string machine, Pros Pro do some good machines. There are quite a few out there. Yeah, like I said, sort of the things to look out for, you have kind of, with electric machines, you have, I don't know if you've seen the ones that they have like a circle disc, you thread the string through the circle disc and that string then turns, which is generally what you'll get in the sort of slightly lower range. I mean, they're great. They'll do the job perfectly. Just if you're stringing it like against a lot of rackets or quite delicate strings, then it could be problematic. But if you're, you know, if you're stringing just your own rackets for, you know, club players, you know, friends, stuff like that, then it's great. Because otherwise, if you do want a good machine, then you're going to have, probably going to have to spend sort of close to 2,000 euros. I like when people ask me, I'd always say either stick to under 1,000 or take the next step up and go kind of close to 2,000 euros.
But you think the Pro Stringer is good for a junior player who might travel a little bit as well? They can bring it with them and they have their constant pull.
Yeah, it's great. I think it's like, I always liked it. I mean, it's one of those things that a lot of stringers don't like, and it's different. It doesn't clamp the racket quite properly. It doesn't do this, doesn't do that. But obviously, like I've been on tour, I've seen some of the stringers at tournaments, and even quite recently, that you just see and you're just like, it's not good. So I think the Pro, like I've always loved it. I mean, I strung a lot of rackets on it. Yeah, I think it's a great option, especially for the price. I think it's really good.
That's good. Ruben will be happy to hear that.
Yeah.
So what are some big do's and don'ts for stringing?
There are a couple of basic, let's say, rules. If you're starting out stringing, always string from the middle. So when you start the racket, you put the strings in the middle, in the center, and you work outwards. So there are old techniques, or let's say not quite right techniques, where you actually weave all the strings, you tie a knot on one side, and then you start pulling the strings across on the mains, which is really not good for the racket, not for the string job, not for anything. So always start the mains from the middle, and try and keep it, if you can, kind of even, couple strings one side, couple strings the other side. Because obviously, if you imagine that, if you start on one side, tie the knot and go all the way across, you're pulling a lot of tension on one side, and the racket's going to end up in a funny shape. The sweet spot will be off. Yeah, it's going to be not a great job. And then same thing with the mains, with the crosses, sorry. I always personally recommend, I always think you should start the crosses at the top. There are some rackets or some rumors, apparently they say you should start at the bottom. I mean, all tournament stringing I've done, all sort of tour level stringing, doesn't matter the racket, we always start the crosses at the top. And that's when I was talking about two knots versus four knots, sometimes you're going to have If you string in one piece, so in two knots, sometimes you finish the mains at the bottom of the racket, and then you think, okay, how am I going to get the racket? Then I have to start at the bottom. But there's actually a technique, it's called around the world. I'm sure there are some YouTube videos, there are other videos on it, which basically means it's a way of managing the string, so you end up finishing with the strings for the crosses at the top, and then you can still work your way down. So yeah, I'd always recommend start like the main strings from the middle and out, and the crosses from top to bottom. Always, they're kind of the two main factors.
And okay, so that should be enough to get somebody stringing.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Did you know we have over 170 great episodes with coaches, players, trainers, and experts working at the highest level of the game? Tap the subscribe button on your podcast app so you don't miss out on the latest episodes of the podcast. And to listen to our great back catalogue of episodes with the biggest game changers in tennis, go to functionaltennispodcast.com.
Okay, so this is something I've seen the website mention. I'm not sure if they even got in contact with me about some promotion, but I've seen the Serengeti method.
Mm-hmm.
I've read about that. They say they have a bigger sweet spot than the average way of stringing a racket. I did check out their website, and they don't seem to have any current top pros using this method endorsing it. So is it just all marketing? What exactly is the Serengeti method of stringing?
Yeah, I mean, basically the Serengeti method is the kind of what I spoke about earlier about the sort of having a different tension to mains and crosses, that each string is actually strung at a different tension, slightly. Again, you need a good electric machine to be able to do this, you know, because if you're changing you're having to change pretty much every string by point X of a kilo or a pound. I know a few guys that have used it and that really like it, and the guys that do use it swear by it. However, but also being a stringer, it's very tiresome.
Sounds like a nightmare. You know,
it is. So I personally don't recommend it, just because there's also a reason that if it was really that great, there would be, you know, a lot more players using it. Personally, I think, you know, sometimes, in my opinion, often people try and reinvent the wheel when, you know, when it's not necessary. Not to say that, you know, that they might be right that it increases a sweet spot. However, it just, is it worth all that time it takes? Like, you know, obviously we string rackets between, you know, 15, 20 minutes a racket, you know, and this will take us maybe 40, 45, you know, and either we have to charge more, you know, or it just takes that much longer. And it's just something that, I know players have tried it, you know, even good players have tried it. All players are always looking for that little bit extra. And if they could get that little bit extra, they would be using it. So that's kind of my take on it. But the theory behind it does make sense, you know, that obviously that each string on a racket does have a slightly different length. You know, there are very few strings of exactly the same length from top to bottom or from side to side. So the theory makes sense. It just makes everything a lot more tricky.
It's what I thought. I didn't know about the time consumption. That makes it even worse. So yeah, thanks for that.
Exactly.
We're going to move on to strings now, so we should be able to quickly move through these.
Yeah.
I want to get some new strings. What's the best way for me to find a new string that I may like? Like, do I speak to a stringer? Do I have to test loads of strings? What's the best and possibly quickest way to find a string that I may like?
The best thing to do is to speak to a stringer, to, you know, either the stringer that you use or a different one, you know, so you can online or you know, find a good-looking pro shop and speak to them. Obviously, just try and... If you do go in asking, or if you do contact someone asking for, you know, for a new string, try to go in with at least some idea of what you're using at the moment, because obviously people often ask, for example, if someone says to me, oh, I need a new string, what should I use? I'm like, well, I've not seen you play. What string do you use? Oh, I'm not sure. What racket do you use? A blue one. I'm like, you know, so that it's very difficult to go off. But there are two main... Well, there are three main types of strings. There's natural gut, then there's synthetic gut, which is a soft multifilament string. So that means it's braided. It's a braided string that is generally a lot softer. You have more feel. They're more powerful. And then you have polyester strings that are a lot stiffer. You get more control, more spin. And they're kind of the three main types. For club players that play, recreational players that play fairly regularly, I generally recommend a hybrid, because I think you get the benefits of having a polyester string, which where you get the spin, you get the control, you get the high impact. But if you use a full bed of poly, can be bad on the arm, can give you arm problems. So I always kind of recommend trying out a hybrid first. And then, I mean, there are lots of different types of strings, but again, for a lot of players, they might not feel all the differences. So it's more a question first finding out the kind of type of string you like. And then if you want to keep trying more strings, you can, within that range, you can kind of keep testing. There are hundreds of thousands of strings and they are all slightly different. However, I would just try to keep it simple. Never try more than three strings at once, because otherwise you go crazy if you try too many. So stick to three different ones. One, okay, this one is quite powerful. This one is intermediate. And this one is generally more control-based or something like that. And then kind of try to go from there.
They're testing some new rackets from Wilson and also was testing different strings at the same time. And yeah, within 3 months, I'd give myself tennis elbow from just changing rackets and strings. And
yeah,
I promise myself I won't do that again, because it was totally involuntary. And tennis elbow can take, was the middle of the summer by the time it started disappearing, and was a complete ruin my summer. So when you do a hybrid with synthetic and poly, which goes where?
Polyester string would go in the mains, in the vertical strings, and then the synthetic would go in the crosses. This is going to give you the best thing. Because if, for example, with gut, you can use gut in the mains and you get a lot more power, but obviously gut is very expensive and breaks a lot easier. So generally, unless you're willing to spend a lot of money, I wouldn't really bother, to be honest, because it is very expensive. And so, yeah, so I would generally always go with the polyester in the mains and then a synthetic in the crosses. And this actually goes for juniors as well. There's actually a kind of a wave, kind of a stringers. We talk about it a lot, that there are too many juniors, young juniors, using all poly strings, like a full bed of poly, which, like, it's really not good for their arms, for their wrists. Like a child, you know, like an 11-year-old, you, again, oh, but Rafa's using this string, I want to use that string. I'm like, yeah, but, you know, that you're not Rafa. You don't have the same biceps that Rafa does, you know. So, like, I always try and avoid kids use, any kid under the age of 12, in my opinion, shouldn't be using full polyester string, because, yeah, it's just not good for them.
What's the Unstrung Customs recommended hybrid string setup? What two strings do you recommend?
It's a tough question, because there are so many. I guess, for example, if we go through price range, let's say there are perhaps three price points. If we go, for example, high end, you have, for example, Luxalon Halo Power in the mains, and then you could have, for example, Technofiber X1, which is probably the best synthetic gut in the crosses, and then you have a sort of a mid-range, mid-price point, you have, for example, like Head Hawk, either the Hawk or the Hawk Touch in the mains, and then you could use their own. They have actually quite a nice soft string called Velocity MLT, which
you could use
Print Synthetic
by head
as well. So these are both head strings. So you've got like Head Hawk or Head Hawk Touch in the mains, and then you've got either their synthetic in the crosses, Head Velocity MLT, or you could use Print Synthetic Gut, which is very, very popular. Synthetic Duraflex, which is, one of the sort of the most popular synthetic strings, especially in the UK. And then again, you have like a low price point. You could use, like an unknown brand of poly with kind of like a basic, print. I think it's called Tournament Synthetic Gut or something like that, which I wouldn't really recommend. I would kind of stick between the kind of the mid, like with everything, you get what you pay for, So if like anything between kind of the mid to high price range, you're going to get more feeling, you're going to get a better feedback. The strings will generally last longer, so sometimes it is worth paying a little bit more, because you will get more playability out of them. You will get more feedback from the string. It'll be nicer on your arm. You will get more power and control. There is a reason that, that certain strings do cost a lot of money compared to other strings. It's not all just plastic.
It's not all just branding.
I mean, sometimes yes, but like it's not all because of branding. So yeah, I mean, I think, for example, a hybrid, if it's the first time you try, stick, between £20 to £30 you want to be spending, €20 to €30, and then kind of go from there.
I did earlier this year start using Luxon, really for the first time in my life.
Yeah, which one? The Alu Power.
Alu Power Soft, and to be honest, the feel. And it was just, I think it helped my arm so much because it was so soft and playability was great. Now, I thought the 4G playability, the feel out of the 4G was amazing. I'd never experienced anything like before, but, and I've never used Natural Guts, so I can't compare with that. But I thought the 4G was great, but I thought it was not friendly on my arm at all. And I think that was probably what caused. I know they have a soft version now, but I haven't tried it, but I'm out of looks. Yeah. I'm actually out of looks on now. I don't hit the ball that hard and it breaks a lot.
Really? Yeah.
My stringers love me using Luxalon.
Yeah.
But I know Solenko are sending me some string now. They're green, their Hyper G string.
Yeah, Hyper G's very nice.
That's quite popular with pro. I see a lot of pros using that.
Yeah, the Hyper-G is great, actually. The Hyper-G is nice. Like, they're kind of their first string, kind of made them famous, especially in the States, was Torbite. Lenko Torbite. I'm not a big fan of Torbite. It's very, very stiff. They do Torbite Soft, which is very nice, which is worth trying. Torbite Soft is nice. It's a little bit softer, a bit nicer on the arm, and the feel is quite good. And then more recently, I think 3 years ago, or 4 years maybe even, they came out with Hyper-G. It's very nice. Just the color is a little bit leery for my taste.
Yeah.
You know, it comes in that neon green. It's a very nice string. They're doing good stuff. But yeah, I mean, the leaders in polyester strings still are Luxulon. Actually, do you know what Luxulon start, like, is what their main business is, or what they started from?
I have no idea.
So they actually started off as, and they still continue to do strings for medical strings. So any kind of thread, any kind of, so, you know, for
like for stitches and
for stitches for, but for like high, you know, like really like high end detailed surgeries. They also do, you know, threading for spacesuits, for, you know, fire, all this kind of yarn, string, thread, that's always what they've specialized in. So like textile string, so textile thread is what they kind of specialized in. And their factory is it's in Belgium, if I remember right.
Yes, Belgium.
And it's quite a small factory, and it's quite a close-knit setup that they have. And that's, they have, from all the, obviously all the other processes that they've done, they've come up with sort of some additives that does still kind of hold them a little bit above the rest of the kind of the pack. There are brands that they're closing in, you know, they're finding different ways that, you know, it always comes with trial and error. I mean, like you said, Solinco doing very nice strings, Favolat as well doing quite good strings, Head are starting to come out with some very nice strings as well. So they're, all the other brands are catching up to them. So the reason, yeah, that they are that good is because they started with textile strings.
I did speak to, I was at the French Open, speaking to the Dunlop rep over there, and they were saying like they just can't figure out what Luxulon do to make their strings so good. And
exactly.
It's just like it said, it's important, you can't compete with them because they just can't figure out their secret sauce. Which is, look, it's great to have a business like that.
Of course.
So just going to, there was a question on tennis elbow and wrist problems. And for me, Luxulon helped a lot with tennis elbow. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Is there any other string? If I came to you and said, hey, Nicky, tennis elbow, I'm struggling. What string should I use? What's the softest string out there?
Yeah.
That's not going to break every hour.
Yeah, Allo Power Soft is nice. It will break quite fast. The Yonex, what's it called? The bright yellow string is called Polytor, maybe. It was also quite, Polytor, that's it. It's also quite fairly arm friendly. It's quite nice. And then Head as well, they do a string called Lynx, just normal Lynx Head.
Is that the blue string?
No, that's Lynx Edge.
Okay.
Which is a little bit stiffer. But yeah, Head Lynx is like the core string from that range. That's very nice on the arm. I recommend it as well for a lot of the juniors that kind of transitioning from using either a hybrid or, you know, synthetic string if they're quite young and then they want to use polyester strings. That's quite a good transition string as well for them. And also I should give a little shout out to Robin Sodling. They do a string. I don't know if you've tried their strings.
They were really good.
Yeah, they do a string called Leon. Yeah, that's their. That's very nice and soft as well. So there are definitely softer strings, but if you do have arm trouble, stay away from 4G, stay away from regular Allo Power, stay away from RPM Blast, because these are strings that are gonna. Because they hold that much tension, you know. But obviously, that tension has to go somewhere, and it generally goes through your arm, unfortunately.
Initially, when functional tennis started, we reached out to Robin Sodling and they sent me so much string. I still have it here and hats and everything. I didn't go with the Leon string. I went for the Paris string.
Like that Paris string as well. It's really nice.
Bit softer, but compared to Luxulon, the feel is just a completely different ball game, I felt.
But it was still
a good string, reasonably priced string.
Yeah, exactly. I like they've done really nice stuff. Their ball's actually very nice as well. I don't know if you've tried their ball. They do a white can. The white can has improved quite a lot on the black can, in my opinion. The white can is very nice. I can't remember what it's called. Tor, maybe? I can't remember. But it's a very nice ball. I like it a lot. And their strings are nice. Yeah, I think for the price, and so I think they're very good. And the grips are good as well. So no, he's done a really nice job. They've done a really good job of creating a brand, because it's not easy to create a string and ball brand. So much competition from the big guys. You need a lot of money to invest. But I think they've done a really nice job.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Okay, so we're going to move on to a few questions on rackets here. Now, Simon from Top Tennis Training always loves to ask some interesting questions that cause a bit of trouble. But he goes, I know, how many pro players actually play with the racket that the sponsor claims that they play with? I do know Head now putting their advertisement that player may not actually play with this racket. Yeah. Specs may differ.
Yeah, yeah.
You see all the pro player rackets, you string a lot of them. How many of them actually play with a racket you can buy off the shelf?
A few of them do. Like, quite a few of them actually do. Because you have to remember as well, the reason that they play with different models, not necessarily because the model is better than the one that they're selling at the moment, it's just because it's the one that they've always played with, which often is what people forget. They're like, oh, but he's using the old blade or the old radical or the old pursuit. That must mean that's better. No, it doesn't mean it's better or worse. It just means that that's the one that he's used for throughout his career. As anyone that knows a tennis player knows that they're creatures of habit and they don't want to change. But for example, Roger, he uses the racket you can buy in the store. You know, it's exactly the same. I mean, he has them personalized or ever so slightly. But yeah, his racket's off, you know, the same. A lot of the guys using the blade, Goffin, like I said, you have the guys using the radical, Schwartzman, he's using the radical. There are plenty of guys. And then, I mean, they're always using the rackets made by, I mean, nearly, well, pretty much always using rackets made by the company that they're endorsing. There was a rumor before, he's playing with a Wilson racket painted as a Head. No, I mean, that doesn't happen. You know, that they are all using rackets made by the company that they're endorsing. But of course, you know, they don't want to change. Racket models are changing every year, you know, and doesn't make sense for players. Like, they shouldn't have to change frame if they're happy with the frame that they have every year. So it's more a question of habit more than, like, people get caught up thinking, oh, pro stock rackets are better. They're using that racket because it's better, because the new ones aren't as good. A lot of the new rackets they're making are great. And you have to remember also the younger generation are going to be using, you know, the rackets that are coming out now in 15 years' time are going to be the old pro stock classic rackets, where, like, right now we're like, oh, no, I don't want to use the current model, radical. It's not as good as the old one or the Prestige or whatever or the Blade. But in 15 years, they're going to be the classic rackets, and people are, oh, such a good racket. It's more a hype, people creating something out of nothing. They do usually use...
It's the usual, you want what you can't have. But if anybody's listening here, whatever racket you have now, store it away. So in 15 years' time, you actually still have it. Yes, yeah, so no, I agree. And I did hear, you did mention Goffin. I did hear that somebody told me that Goffin uses off the shelf, doesn't even customize it. He just uses it exactly the way it comes off the shelf, which is great to hear.
It does happen.
What's a similar, I know we talked a bit about Murray's old racket, the Blue Pro Tour, the Thomas Muster racket. What's a similar racket to that now? If I wanted to buy one from Tennis Warehouse today, what's the closest racket to that?
I mean, the current model Head Prestige, to be honest, the 1820 mid-plus Prestige. I mean, it's the same mold, you know, it's just the layout. It's obviously the materials have also changed from, you know, so that's also why things, you know, that players are using different older rackets, because the materials have changed, but they like the older materials or they like the materials they used to use. Doesn't mean that they're better or worse. I mean, I would argue that the current model rackets of all the brands are better than most of their older ones. There are exceptions that, you know, that they've made mistakes. For example, Babolat made, you know, a little mistake with their trying to change the string pattern on, or the string setup on one of the, like, their pure drives. And so, like, but they could revert back and they change, you know. But in general, yeah, if someone does want something similar to the old Pro Tour, it's the current mid-class Prestige.
Great. And this is a very technical question. What's the difference between a tubular and a square frame?
Well, square frame, I guess, is fairly obvious. It means that, you know, that it's kind of all the angles are quite, like, they're all right angles to the frame. For example, the Prestige is a square beam racket. There aren't actually that many about these days. Most of the rackets change in beam width or in beam shape. So, for example, the Aero Drive or the Pure Aero, I think it's called now, the one that Rafa uses, you know, it has that kind of very distinctive aerodynamic throat, and then it goes up to, like, a thicker, wider beam at the top. It's normally because it increases swing speed, it can increase stability, torsion, whereas a square beam actually makes the racket experience a little bit more dead, and it can actually move a bit more. And that's kind of why that I think companies have moved away from that, because it means the racket has to be heavier to be stable. You know, because obviously nowadays, you know, you can have a great solid feeling racket that only weighs 280 grams or 290 grams, which in a square beam would be impossible. And that's because of the physics in the setup of the frame.
What's an ideal racket for a 12-year-old? Who plays a bit, by the way, sorry. 12-year-olds who playing like four times a week and is playing tournaments.
Okay, yeah. So obviously, I mean, the thing is always, I mean, with any racket for any player, young, old, it's always relative to their physical capabilities, to their, you know, to their tennis level. For a 12-year-old that is, you know, that is competing, I would look for a racket around 300 grams, plus or minus. Depends as well is if they're, you know, strong or if they're bigger for their age, small for their age. But yeah, somewhere between, let's say, 285 to no more than 305 grams. You want as well, more recently, there's been this big wave of like big spin rackets, you know, where they have very, very open string patterns. I personally try and stay away from them because they just, you lose a lot of feeling of the strings break a lot, so you know it's not ideal for the parents. And so I would say, you know, like a anywhere between plus give or take 290 grams plus or minus, probably a 16-19 string pattern, you know, which is enough to give them, you know, spin power, but they still get feeling, they still get feedback from the racket. And I wouldn't, around 100 square inch head, which to be honest, most of the rackets in that weight range will be 100 square inch head.
One of the questions to hear was what was a good racket for topspin, but you recommend anybody who's looking for topspin should look at it like a 16-19 string pattern.
Yeah, I mean, for example, topspin, again, it comes from a lot of players. A lot of people ask me, what string would help my serve, or what racket would be better for my forehand? And then the answer that I want to give is always, maybe take more tennis lessons, you know, because at the end of the day, a racket can help, you know, but it won't solve the problem. You know, for top spin, either the reason you're not getting enough top spin is either because the racket's too heavy, you can't swing it fast enough. The string pattern is too dense, so it means, you know, that maybe you're playing with an 18-20. So look for a more open string pattern. But again, I wouldn't go any bigger than 16-19, 16-18. There's also 18-16, but the gaps are very, very big. You're going to lose a lot of control. Again, I'm not a big fan personally. So I would just stick to the kind of the classic 16-19. And then look at the strings. The strings do make a difference. Try a couple of, let's say, spin-orientated strings. That'll probably help you more than the racket itself. I mean, if you're using a sensible racket, then the strings are generally will be a better option for you.
Great. Okay, last racket question. And you touched on this earlier about Novak extended his racket, but what are the pros and cons of extended rackets?
Yeah, so the pros and cons are, so normally all rackets come at a sort of regular length, which, if I'm not mistaken, is 6. I should know this. I think it's 69 and a half inches. And the longer the racket is, the more power you get. So you get more power. You obviously, I mean, whenever a lever is longer, you get more power. So obviously, if you have longer arms, if you have a longer racket, you're going to get more power. But obviously, the further away you are from the point of impact, so the longer the racket is, the less control you're going to get. The more movement you're going to get in the racket, it's going to be harder to control. So I generally don't recommend extended rackets. Obviously, someone like Novak he could play with a stick if you wanted to, you know. So I generally recommend sticking to a regular length, 27-inch regular length frame, because when you go above that, the racket starts to move. They're also more difficult to find, to be honest, and that extra little bit of, I would first, if someone wants more power, instead of looking to get a longer racket, I would try again adjusting either the specs of the racket or the tension of the strings, you know, lower the tension if you want a little bit more power, because unless you have a very good reason to wanting an extended racket, I would kind of stick to regular length 27-inch racket.
Great. There was a time, I remember years ago, where Prince were, maybe a few other brands were into the extended rackets, and they were quite popular, but they've died down now. So,
because players are, you know, they're serving so hard, they hit the ball so hard, they just can't control the ball in the same way. If you hit very flat or kind of smooth strokes, then you can do it. Actually, do you remember Xavier Melisse?
Yes.
Yeah, he used to use that, what was it called? I think it was called the Prince Diablo, maybe the red one, and that was the longest you could have a racket was 29 inches, and it was literally like a broomstick. But again, the only few players Novak is using a half inch longer.
They just put a bit extra on the grip, or does it mold it directly, do head directly make that for him?
Generally all rackets come, so when a racket is made, obviously you have a carbon that goes into a mold, and that mold is an open, and that so the shaft of the racket where the grip would go is all nearly always, I think it's even 30 inches, like makes the racket 30 inches in length. And then the racket's always cut to regular length, and then the pallet or the mould is put on. So obviously for him, the hairpin of the racket could be any length, obviously within regulation. So they basically, they just cut the racket at a different length.
So next, Nicky, we're just going to move into the racket mod section, to the customization section. And I'm going to kick off with, what are the benefits of a leather grip?
So leather grips obviously were popular years ago, and they a lot of pro players use leather grips. The benefits of a leather grip basically allows you to feel the bevels of the grip more. It also gives you a firmer contact, so you actually, again, you'll end up getting more vibration through your arm or through your hand. But that all, so basically the vibrations of a racket are basically feedback from how you're hitting the ball. So for pro players, obviously the more feedback they get, the better. But again, for recreational players, if you're using a leather grip, it's quite tough on the hand. Obviously it's a lot harder, it's a lot firmer than the synthetic grips. You know, you can end up with sore hands, you can end up with, you know, blisters, and you're going to get more tension through the elbow, through your arm, through your wrist. It's just the question of feedback. You know, you can feel the edges of the rackets, you can find the grip, you know, the grip you need for the shot slightly better, slightly faster, and you just get that firm feeling. So that's kind of the main benefit.
Fran, when he did up my radicals, did put some leather grips on them, and I thought they're great. I remember as a kid trying them with the old Princes, and I thought they were rough, like. But now, actually, I really enjoyed them. I wish I'd done it sooner. Is there any particular brand you recommend? I see P1 have their own leather grip. What's the best leather grip brand? Ashway, is there a brand called Ashway?
Yeah, there's a brand called Ashway. Fairway. Fairway. They're kind of the classic. Ashway is a string band that make they make squash strings. Fairway, it's kind of the classic. Yeah, they use a high grade leather. But to be honest, I mean, there's kind of, again, the ones that are most sought after are the head calfskin leather grips, which are kind of, again, they're kind of just for pro players. There are a few ways of getting them, but to be honest, the Wilson leather grips are quite fine. For me, actually, the best sort of off the shelf, you have Gamma ones that you can get, I think, from Tennis Warehouse. You can get them from String Forum. You can get them from different places, and they're very nice. So basically, the most important thing about the leather grips is that when you stretch them, they don't deform too much, they don't stretch too much, so they should be firm, and that they're consistent in width. And actually, a lot of the main factor of a leather grip is actually the person putting the leather grip on. If a leather grip is applied badly, it's horrible. You could have a great leather grip applied badly and it'll feel terrible. And if you have even a bad leather grip applied well, it'll feel nice. So it's actually more a question of the application than anything else. I remember Nate from P1 once said, if you don't get hand cramp while applying a leather grip, you haven't put it on properly.
Love it. One of the questions was that I got was, like, I need to see a leather grip being put on properly. So that's what I'm going to ask you for it over the next while. No rush to get a nice video of a leather grip.
We'll do a cool video of that. Yeah, we can do that for you. No problem.
Great. Okay. So briefly talk about weight on a racket. So what's the difference between putting weight on the handle, weight on the top of the frame, or weight at 6 and 9 o'clock? What's the main differences?
Okay, so obviously depending where you add weight, and normally when we add weight, we use lead tape, which is kind of what you'll see on kind of the outside of the frame. Sometimes it's under the bumper. So you have three ways of measuring the racket. You have the static weight, which is just the weight, pure weight of the racket when you put it on a scale. Then you have the balancing point of the racket, which is at which point when the racket's flat on a, let's say, flat table, it's at what point, for example, if you push the racket to the edge of the table, at what point does the racket just balance before it falls off? This is called the balancing point. Or if you have it on your, you know, finger or wherever, that's called the balancing point. And then you have the third mark, which is swing weight, which is actually the weight of the racket when it's swinging, which is measured just a swing. It's called a swing weight machine, funny enough. That'll give you a reading of the racket when it's moving, which is actually often one of the most important ones, because obviously that's kind of the weight that we feel. That's why sometimes you can hold a racket and you'd be like, oh, this feels really heavy. And then you actually go and weigh it and it's not, or vice versa. You can be like, oh, this feels very nice. This doesn't feel too heavy. And that's because of the swing weight. So depending on where you place the racket, it affects. The higher up the racket, it'll increase the swing weight a lot more, and it'll make it more head heavy, meaning it'll give you more power, but it'll be more difficult to swing. And then if you add it more to the grip, it'll mean the racket's going to be easier to maneuver. So you can swing it faster, you can accelerate it quicker. However, you won't get as much power through the ball.
Which one provides a better stable racket?
Yeah, so if you want stability, so if you feel that, for example, the racket is twisting ever so slightly when you play, or it's moving slightly, then you'll see a lot of weight being added kind of around the sweet spot zone, which is kind of just above 3-9, kind of 10-2, 3-9, something like that. It's kind of the zone where you hit the ball, and that just the extra weight basically adds weight to the plow through. So when you hit through the ball, that weight is getting pushed with the ball through the ball, and you get just a more stable feel and a little bit more power through the shot.
Okay, great. And you mentioned swing weight there. Somebody asked, what's the best swing weight machine?
There are a couple swing weight machines. So Babolat do like a whole diagnostic center. It's nice, but it's a very, very expensive. I think it's around €6,000. Yeah, and that'll tell you also the flex of the racket. It'll tell you the swing weight. It'll tell you the string bed dynamic tension. It can tell you a whole host of things. And then you have the machine that I use, which is the head 3-in-1 swing weight machine, which is, it's great. It looks very nice. I don't know if you've seen it. It looks great. But that'll do obviously the static weight. Has nice electrical scale. Then it'll do the balance point, and then it'll do the swing weight as well. So that's obviously why it's called 3-in-1. And that, I can't remember the exact retail price. I think it's around about just between €1,500 to €2,000. And that'll, for example, if you buy that, then you can do all the customizing your heart desires. It'll be able to, you know, and it's a great machine.
You can set up a nice business.
Yeah, and it's not too big. If you do need to move around a bit, it's not, you know, you can pick it up, move it around. It's smaller than a string machine. And then you have my colleague Fran. He's using it's called the Dunlop swing weight machine, and that just measures swing weight. So it's a slightly even smaller unit, and that'll just do the swing weight, which is nice. It's quite handy. It's quite small, but for like if you want the full kind of package, let's say, then I think, you know, the head 3-in-1 is a nice option. At least I like it a lot. Yeah, the old popular one was the Prince one. They did a Prince 3-in-1, but that doesn't exist anymore. So it's quite difficult to find. So this is kind of the next in line.
I think my pro shop in Dublin here, the club I'm at, have one. The Prince one rings a bell, but
yeah, it's like green and kind of see-through green.
See-through, yeah, that's the one. So tell me, so if I'm a player and I was like, God, my rackets all feel different, or I want to change something, but I like my rackets, how do I go about finding the perfect spec for me?
Well, obviously, whenever you buy two rackets or more, the chance of them being slightly different is nearly 100%. It's very, very high.
They say now plus or minus 7 grams on any specific racket, which is crazy.
Yeah. The only brand that does very, very good, accurate, off-the-shelf specs is Yonex. They do a very nice job on the quality control of their specs. Otherwise, Wilson ahead there, they have plus or minus 7 grams of difference, which is a lot. And it also means that sometimes, for example, you could buy four rackets and you could give me four rackets. Oh, I want them all the same. And I can tell you, to be honest, it's nearly impossible. To find the ideal specs, I mean, you need to speak to someone that knows what they're doing with regards to customizing. And then if you have an idea of how you play, so, okay, I'm you know, 6 foot tall, I have a one-handed backhand, I like to play aggressive, then normally I would say within three tests, I can normally find something you like. You know, if you're able to explain to me, okay, this is how I play, and if you send me a video or if I see how you play, this is what I've been playing with, this is kind of what I like, but I feel I need a bit more power. I feel like I can't really sometimes swing the racket fast enough, or, you know, as long as you give me some kind of, you know, good feedback, then and we normally do kind of two or three test frames for clients or for players, and then within those two or three tests we can normally narrow it down to, okay, this is the one I like, or I really like this one but it's maybe just a little bit too heavy, and then I say, okay, that's it, then we can do four of them exactly the same, or whatever, two of them or six of them, however many rackets you have.
You do work with people like this where they send you videos,
yes,
messages, then they send you the rackets and you send them back a few rackets and then they pick which one they want.
Yes. Exactly. Yes, we do. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we do video analysis work, which is great. It helps a lot because obviously when someone just tells us, hey, I need more, like we were talking about earlier, I want more topspin on my forehand, where should I put the weight? And then without seeing them play, I'm, you know, okay, well, maybe put a bit in the head because it will increase, you know, the power in the racket and you swing it or whatever. But then if I see that they, you know, using the wrong grip to get topspin or whatever, then it helps. It helps a lot with regards to finding the right specs. And yeah, we do that for, we do it for not just for pro players, we do it for club players, you know, recreational players, anyone that, you know, that feel, okay, you know, that are keen tennis players that want a bit more out of their racket. And I'd always recommend, you know, anyone that plays regularly that has more than one racket should ideally get them at least matched. You know, like, not everyone needs to have a perfectly customized racket exactly for them. But if you have more than one, so you have two of the same racket, take them to your sort of local stringer or customizer and just ask them to make them the same. You know, that means if you break a string, the next one you pick up is the same. You don't need to have a favorite racket. That I'd always recommend.
Most people normally have a favorite racket and they don't know why it's their favorite racket.
Exactly.
But these are reasons why it could be their favorite racket, because they are different weights and the sweet spot could be different. Or just so, yes, finally, we can get them problems sorted. Now, every racket can be your favorite racket.
Exactly.
There's a question here that I thought was a wrong question, but maybe you can tell me if it's not. The question was from Gary over in New York, was how accurate is silicone versus lead tape putting weight in rackets? I replied back and said, Gary, I think you only put silicone in the bottom of the racket, in the grip handle. Mm-hmm. And he goes, no, you can put silicone in the frame of the racket. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure. I'll ask the expert.
You don't want to put silicone in the frame. Silicone only just goes in. So if you open up the trap door of a racket, you'll see that it goes into the bottom shaft of the racket. It's very accurate. Yeah, it's great. Obviously, you know roughly how much silicone. I mean, obviously, in experience, you know, you get to know how much silicone you need to put in to roughly get whatever weight you need. But then, you know, you put a bit in, you weigh it, make sure it's right. You go, you know, bit by bit, step by step. And obviously then as well, depending how deep in the racket grip you put the silicone, it will also adjust the weight and the swing weight. So that's why, you know, like, customizing rackets is quite a delicate art. But I wouldn't put silicone in the actual, like, in the head frame of the racket. You might see that some rackets have foam, like a lot of the Wilson rackets have foam in them, but that's done in the factory and that's part of the makeup of the racket.
Okay.
You know, is that foam? But that's not injected afterwards.
That's what I thought. Do any pros play with a swing weight less than 320, which I assume is a very fast racket?
I mean, depends also as well as the swing weight, 320 with strings or without strings. But if it's with strings, there will be plenty, especially on the feet. Especially, you know, on the women's tour.
I did hear Dominic Thiem plays with a really fast moving racket.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not 100%, but I think he uses a racket that is quite grip heavy, that makes it, you know, that you can swing it very fast. So there are, I don't know what the lowest swing rate I've seen, I don't remember, because obviously as well, I only test the rackets that I work with. For example, you know, if you're at a tournament or you're stringing, you don't kind of check out the specs. Yeah, no, you're too busy. And also just, you know, at the end of the day, like, they're personal to the player, you know, and some players don't like, you know, don't want their specs shared. Some players don't mind. Yeah, we leave it up to the player to kind of, whether or not they want to kind of release their specs or not.
Great. Okay, we're going to move on to the last section, which is only have a couple of questions, but it's basically on paint and rackets, which you and Unstrung have become world leaders in. I've seen some of your painted rackets. They're really good. The quality is amazing. First, we have a question from Lucas, who says, can you paint a racket at home?
Yeah, well, so basically the way we got into racket painting was actually I was just finishing playing. I was playing a few more tournaments and I didn't have a contract left on my racket sponsors. So I just decided to get my rackets painted black. You know, I thought it'd be cool. I just got guy that paints racket that paints cars, sorry, just to kind of spray it. I took the grommets out and I just got them to spray the racket black. At the time, you know, I wasn't thinking of the weight. I mean, yeah. I knew it would increase the weight, but I wasn't, you know, it was just like, okay, just paint them black and it'll be fine, you know. And that's what I did. And then we posted a couple of photos on Instagram and people were like, oh, awesome. And then from there it kind of grew bit by bit. We were doing a lot of testing to kind of get to where we're at now. I mean, we're still trying to get better and better all the time, like anything. But in answer to your question, yes, you can paint them at home. You need patience and I guess as well kind of a good touch to being a little bit artistic, because so for example, if you do want to paint a racket at home, I mean, I definitely wouldn't advise doing it inside at home. I'd maybe do it in the garage or somewhere covered. But basically the process is quite simple. We in the sense that we sand the rackets down, so we remove the current paint job of the racket, because obviously this as well, now whenever we paint a racket, we return the racket within plus or minus 2 grams that we received the rackets in, you know, which is quite good. And they keep the same feeling the same flex. So they do come back feeling the same, because obviously their questions would get, oh, well, my racket feel the same, will it be the same weight, blah, blah. But yes, at least when we paint them, they'll come back the same. But if you're going to paint them at home, you want to sand the racket down, take your time, remove all the paint. And then, you know, like you would kind of paint anything, you need to primer them. And like anything, if it's worth getting good quality stuff. And then you can use...
What paint do you recommend?
To paint at home, I would recommend going to... Do you guys have, like a Halfords, like a car parts auto store type thing?
Yeah, auto store.
Yeah, exactly. Because obviously, if you're going to paint them at home, you don't need to get, a spray gun. You don't need to get, the whole setup. You can do a fairly decent job with spray cans with some practice. And I would recommend, if you're going to try at home, I would try with that. So yeah, so go and get to, go to your kind of auto store, get some primer, and then, get, the color that you want or the couple of colors that you like.
And is it spray or paint?
This is spray. Like, you could do it from home. You can do it with spray cans. So like spray paint. There are a couple of different types of spray cans, but definitely for this, or like try and get the ones that you'd use for cars, so on, because they're high pressure. You want high pressure cans. For example, graffiti spray paint is low pressure, which means the paint comes out a lot slower, which just for painting rackets is very difficult. Stay away from graffiti cans. But yeah, you can try any high pressure paint can. Again, you might find that some paints don't, like different brands don't mix with other paints. And again, it comes with technique. You might get orange peel, which is kind of when the paint basically looks like orange peel. But it can be done. You can do, you can do some kind of quite nice, simple designs. And then obviously after you let it dry, and then you want to add a lacquer to the racket and let that dry nice and hard. Obviously, the one thing that they do in the factory that we can't do, the rackets are painted before the grips are applied, which basically means that they can be put in an oven. So they dry a lot faster, a lot harder, a lot quicker. Whereas once they have the grip on, you need to just be patient and let them dry for 3 to 5 days.
Unless you're getting a new custom mold.
Exactly. Then you could take Then you can take it off, and then we pop them in the oven, so it helps.
Okay.
So
it's good. It sounds anybody can do it. So guys, give it a go. Mm-hmm. And so if I want to send you my racket to be done, what's the time frame?
So the time frame is usually 10 days, give or take, from when we receive the rackets, because obviously, with each color, with each layer, we need to let the paint dry around sort of 12 to 24 hours. So obviously, say, you have a design with four different colors, but just in drying time, that's nearly three days of drying time. 4 days of drying, plus you need to sand them, plus when the lacquer goes on, we try to leave them for 48 hours before we put the bumpers on, before we string them or anything like that. So that's why it takes roughly 10 days, give or take, from when we receive the frame.
Great. Well, look, Nicky, yeah, you answered all the paint questions right there. So thanks for that.
Perfect.
If anybody's looking for any information on modern rackets, on painting rackets, on anything got to do with rackets, you can contact Nicky on Instagram at Unstrung Customs or through their website at unstrungcustoms.com. But I have one last question for you. It's a big question. How many rackets have you strung in your stringing career?
That's a very good question. I would say close to 10,000, maybe, I think I would say. I would say close, maybe more than 10,000 rackets.
Great. Well, fair play. That's a lot of experience there. And
yeah, it's a lot of practice.
Congrats on a great stringing career so far, and all the best to Unstrung Customs in the future. Thank you very much. That was great. Very informative. I can't wait to our audience to hear this and get their questions answered. It was very informative. I didn't know a lot of this stuff as well, and I've been in tennis a long time. So it was great to get the information from a great source. So thank you very much.
Perfect. Pleasure. Yeah, it was great. It was fun.
Hope you found that interesting. I really did, and learned so much from it. If you happen to know anybody who's into strings, rackets, or customization, please share this podcast with them. Again, thanks for listening. Make sure you hit subscribe button, and I'll catch you next week. Bye.